Spurs to score under 1.5 goals against Middlesbrough? Correct. Jordan Williams to score any time in the Chris Wilder derby? Correct. And Wolves to beat Manchester United? Incorrect. Welcome to another episode of the Squawker Talker Football Podcast, sponsored by BetBall. My name is Jake Entwistle, and I got my prediction right on this week's accumulator, and the fact that my player to watch didn't even play. So Ainsley Pearce, not in goal for Middlesbrough, doesn't matter because they were against Jose Mourinho's Harry Kane-less Spurs. Will, your deep dive into FC-filed strikers came up clutch.
You're welcome. To all of you, you're welcome.
Well, it doesn't matter in the end because you should never bet alone with BetBall, remember, if you're 18 plus and gambling aware. That is their thing. And we didn't bet alone this week. But Mo, because of that,
yes,
Wolves to win.
I mean, United had no shots on target. I mean, that's got to be worth something,
right? It was a moral victory.
Well, yes, that's right. I'm claiming a moral victory.
Do the bookies pay out on moral victory?
I guess no.
I'm going to say they don't.
United were horrible, but it was just Wolves decided not to crucify them for it like you expected they would.
Well, Jimenez came on, was trying Rabona shot, smacked one against the bar from like the tightest of angles.
If he had started, I think it would have been.
So blame it on that. And our final guest this week, I've used that to introduce the new way to introduce the guest. You didn't have a prediction with us on the latest BetBall accumulator, but you will be on this week's one. Oliver Young-Miles is back.
Hello.
On the Squawker Talker. Happy New Year.
You too.
Thank you very much. And we'll go straight into, again, so many games happening at the moment. We're not even going to review those FA Cup games that we picked out the predictions for. We're going to go straight into some Carabao Cup action, of which there were two games, both home teams failing to win. Mm-hmm. And we'll start with the first game of the week, which was Man United. They lost this one, Mo.
Yes, they did.
3-1 to Manchester City.
Off by 3 days.
And according to Kevin De Bruyne, it only took 15 minutes to figure out how to absolutely dismantle them in one half.
Yeah, I mean, it was... Look, after what happened at the Etihad, yeah, Guardiola... when United beat them 2-1, and it honestly should have been like more like 3 or 4-1. United were so much better than City on the counter-attack. You had to feel like Guardiola was going to do something different. I knew he would. I said so. I got 4 out of 5 of my predictions correct as well, by the way.
Ooh.
In the article. I was just wrong because I thought United would win.
I would say you got the most important one wrong.
Yes, yeah. obviously. But
can you clarify what that prediction was?
I said United would win just about. I thought it would be like 1-0 or 2-1 United. Obviously, and they didn't.
They lost.
It was
What's
close.
The opposite of just about?
Yeah, it's just completely,
a lot about.
Completely destroyed. Guardiola adjusted very sensibly. Right, the first thing was obviously he instead of playing, this is the thing with Guardiola's midfields historically have been one holder, like a 6, and then a sort of 8/6, so like a midfield like Xavi, and then a more attacking player like an Iniesta, right? That's the archetype he's used. And at Man City, he's never really had that. He turned David Silva, who is an attacking midfielder, like a pure 10, into like a central midfielder, and De Bruyne as well, same sort of thing, was a winger. And that's made them great attacking, and then obviously defensively, though, they've been ripped on the break, which is why in Europe, they constantly get hosed by teams because they can't handle the counterattack. Obviously, in Bayern, he used his... inverted his fullbacks as a way to counter-attack, deal with that. Hasn't really done that too much at City. A little bit with Walker, not massively so. I think partly because he needs his fullbacks to be a bit more overlapping.
Without Sané especially.
And he doesn't, I mean, and in the Bundesliga, he had Robin and Ribery. Like, you can leave those guys on an island and they'll take care of it. You don't have that quite level of dribbling menace at City, except for Sané.
Mahrez is quite good.
Only now he's playing Mahrez, though. Before he wasn't. So maybe now we'll see that. And we saw Mahrez play and play very well against United. Up the middle, diced them. Beautiful goal went around there. But he adjusted. Gundogan was in midfield. In the 2-1, it was Rodri, it was De Bruyne, it was Silva. And predictably, United were like, oh, hey, loads of space. And they just tore into the spaces behind De Bruyne and Silva. Killed City that way. On Tuesday, it was again Rodri, again De Bruyne, but Gundogan in there. So that's two. That's the classic, more classic Guardiola style midfield, where you've got a defensive midfielder, a central midfielder, an attacking midfielder. You've got an actual balance in there, and Gundogan just helped City control possession more, because David Silva, he just always gets in the box and plays final third pass and everything. And that's great. That's what he's good at, but that leaves City vulnerable on the break. Gundogan was a bit deeper, a bit closer to Rodri, helped him a little bit manage transitions. That helped. Mendy instead of Angelino helped in defence. But, you know, otherwise it wasn't like...
But it was surely the fourth midfielder. Yeah, Bernardo after the fact said, well, Pep just said we needed a couple more bodies in midfield, so I played. And
yeah, I mean, and then that was the other thing as well. You drop the striker because you don't really need... United have shown that you don't really need the insistence... two things with the striker. One thing is obviously you don't have a body in midfield. With Bernardo Silva, you then had a body in midfield. You had Mahrez and Sterling operating kind of as wing forwards on their own. False nine allowed you to get more control in midfield, have that basically a diamond shape in there against City... against United, sorry. And then also it removes the verticality from your play to a degree. Like when you have a striker up front, there's more of an insistence to go forward and attack when you have someone up there. When you don't have a striker up there, you're more content to just sort of ping, 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 ping the ball around and be more considered, look for the passes more so. And with City's, with United's defenders, without Maguire, have no concept of how to defend space. So Sterling was getting in behind like a million, like every 5 seconds.
From the stuff I watched as well, a lot of it was down that right-hand side, and they sort of, as you said, because there was no middle focal point, a lot of the possession was out wide, and then they'd just two or three passes someone would run through.
They
and
targeted
was...
Williams because for two reasons. One is he's not Wan-Bissaka, so you can actually get at him, whereas Wan-Bissaka's like a brick wall. Mm. And his centre-back was Jones, who isn't as good as Lindelof, obviously. And Jones was awful, had a really bad evening. Didn't get that much protection, to be fair, from the midfield with Andres Pereira in midfield. That was a huge mistake from Solskjaer.
Had his Jerome Boateng moment as well.
Yes, poor guy. Got De Bruyne'd. Solskjaer got it all wrong as well. Like, it wasn't just Guardiola. Guardiola made good adjustments. Solskjaer made bad ones. Okay, look, doesn't have McTominay from injury. Doesn't have Maguire from injury. Two of the most important players for United defensively. But he replaced them with Pereira and with Jones. Rojo is fit. Why? I know they're trying to sell him, but you got to play him in this kind of game. You can't play Jones. And Pereira in midfield, I mean, I'm not a big fan of Matic, as everyone knows, but Matic is good at one thing, and that's stopping people getting past him. He's a big lad.
Course. When it suits.
No, I've always said that. The big problem with Matic is he can't pass out the ball out the back quickly, but in this game, it was clear. And in the second half, that's why United did well. They sort of kind of matched the shape of City with bringing on Matic, and they sat him deep, and all he did was just tackle people. He had, like, I think, four or five tackles more than the entire rest of the United team. So it was, that's what was missing in the first half. But in that, as De Bruyne says, in that first, they figured out what United were doing and they caned him. And frankly, so much of United in the second half was down to the fact that City were just so far ahead. And Rashford scoring in a big game is automatic. Mm. Would it have happened if City had needed to keep their sheet clean? Maybe not. Mm. I don't know.
Another good finish as well.
It was a great finish. And he's really improving. And
After that was... Again, the classic, imagine him in Guardiola's side and does he deserve better than Man United?
He definitely does.
And, that brings me on to the final Man United focus from that game. Yeah. Again, there's a second leg to play. You never know what could happen. Man United have been better at the Etihad than they have at Old Trafford against Man City anyway. Yeah. So that goal could plant the seed of doubt in Man City.
If they score early at the Etihad, you never know.
But with League Cup now looking like it's a bit, obviously Solskjaer referenced the PSG comeback, but that ended up coming to nothing. What represents success for this Man United team this season? Or is there a chance of no success at all?
Champions League football in 2020-2021. That's the success. The winning a trophy, that would be great. Winning the League Cup, winning the FA Cup, although God knows if that's going to happen, or even winning the Europa League if they can do it. Fantastic. What's important is getting back in the Champions League because it's hampering their recruitment. Man United probably would have signed Jadon Sancho in the summer if it had been the Champions League. He was like, I'm not dropping out of the Champions League. I'm staying. And why would he, right? Why should he? You know, you want the best players. Paul Pogba is probably agitating to leave right now because he wants to play in the Champions League. And why shouldn't he? He's a Champions League player. United, and I'm sure financially it's a factor as well, although, but United makes so much money. I don't think that's that big of a deal.
I think I've shown time and time again, they've got money to burn.
Yeah. Sporting-wise, you can't...
That can only last so long, though, because I think...
You've got a farm tractor, official tractor contract.
Yeah, Woodward is a banker. He's excellent at conjuring money out of nowhere. The problem is, sporting-wise, you're not going to be able to attract really good quality players to the club. Right. And I mean,
here we go then.
Yeah.
Good quality players to the club. The latest rumour that has appeared from Man United is Donny van der Beek from Ajax. They aren't in the Champions League, so they don't have he doesn't have the Jadon Sancho. I'm in the Champions League. Let me just see out the season. Mm-hmm. Ajax surprisingly fell out in that really tight group with Chelsea and Valencia at the last moment. Hakim Ziyech is now sort of again on the market being linked to everyone. But it's Van den Beek that's been the the person linked closely to Man United, and I think that's because he fills the void of goal-scoring midfielder, not deep, but attacking.
What,
is he actually... Is this a rumour that makes sense, and should it be taken seriously? And is he the person they should be rumoured to be linked with, Will?
To answer the first question, the fact several strong sources, those being The Telegraph and ESPN in the UK, and Vertebal International, among others over in Holland, are all covering it, suggests we should take it seriously. On the other hand, the UK reports are written in quite cautious language. That's not uncommon, but Donny van der Beek has said previously, in fact only a couple months ago, that he doesn't like the idea of leaving the club halfway through the season. And one of the Dutch news versions I read also says Ajax won't sell in the winter. So van der Beek would have to climb down from those comments, and Ajax would have to be persuaded to sell earlier than they would like if Man United are to sign him. But with those reservations out of the way, I think it's an interesting story with regards to the other questions you had as to whether he is the right type of the player that Manchester United need to come in. So here's the breakdown. But Paul Pogba and Scott McTominay are injured, of course. And the attacking output of Jesse Lingard and Andreas Pereira hasn't been encouraging. So, and Mo's been banging this drum for a while. It seems United now feel they need an attacking midfielder. Or midfield reinforcements of some type. And top of the list is of targets currently, in terms of attainable targets, according to these reports, is Donny van der Beek, who Ajax is said to value at 50 million. One key thread I read in the ESPN report is that United think Ajax, because of that elimination of the Champions League that you referenced, will be open to selling due to the financial implications of dropping down into Europa League. In terms of where he fits in, we looked into positions played yesterday, and throughout his career, it seems like he's played pretty much everywhere, even at right back, I think.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's not...
I got that he's been getting further up the pitch as time progressed. That would be my chart.
Much of this is going to be to do with Ajax's concept of total football, and everyone should be able to play in every position. And also part of it, I would imagine, is due to how young players tend to develop. You don't really want to plonk an 18-year-old in central midfield, because that's a position that leaves you quite vulnerable, more so than if you sort of lose possession on the flanks. So, but as he's sort of progressed and developed, it seems like he's exclusively, well, certainly last season in the knockout stage of the Champions League, he exclusively played in that sort of central attacking midfield
Shadow striker.
Shadow striker slash number 10 in the 4-2-3-1 Den Haag used. He's also played sort of in the two-man pivot when Ziyech plays at that number 10. Although I don't think he's looked to as the defender when playing there. That said, he's also someone who presses and recovers possession quite well. And I think that might appeal to Manchester United as they seem to be veering towards this new sort of transition football trend that's not even emerging in modern football. It's like fully established in modern football right now. I would see him as sort of being that maybe Dele Alli type number 10 shadow striker. Yeah. You position in where I think Andreas Pereira played against City.
And where Lingard's been playing.
Lingard played there against City. You could also move him back into Fred's role or Pereira's role even when he plays in that two-man pivot.
The thing with Donny is it makes the
first name basis.
It makes so much sense to me because obviously you look at Pogba departing, and Pogba provides a lot of verticality, a lot of goals, a lot of presence in the final third, a lot of little touches around the corner, nice little assist. And he can do that. Donny van der Beek can do it. We saw that for Ajax last season. This season is always seeing it. He scores goals, scores big goals, isn't afraid of big occasions, can shoot off either foot. So on that level, yeah, that makes perfect sense. On the other hand, you look at both Ajax and the Netherlands, they have creative players that create chances that he can finish. United have none. Sign Donny van der Beek, great, do that. But you have to sign a creator as well, because otherwise, what's he scoring from? Who's passing the ball to him? You look at in the
Magic.
Since the start of 2017-18 in the top five leagues, right? Well, in the Premier League and in the Eredivisie, Pogba's created 12 big chances. Martial's created 17. Rashford's created 18. Van der Beek's created 22. Very impressive. Hakim Ziyech created 69.
Nice.
He's the guy. If United are targeting someone from Ajax, it's Hakim Ziyech. He can dribble. He can create. He can play the number 10 or right wing. I mean, if United have the money, sign them both. Because United need a right winger as well.
Ziyech is a really strange one in that, I was convinced he was going to be snapped up the moment. It came out that Ajax had made a gentleman's agreement to sell him if the right offer came in. But to throw that Van der Beek point you just raised back at you.
Ooh.
I think part of United's problem has been finishing this season.
Definitely.
And they do have, like, Rashford's quite a creative player. Martial can create by, like, dribbling at people and then...
I've liked Martial in number nine as well.
And then making that little reverse pass.
Yeah,
and
Martial plays like Benzema.
You could see Van der Beek getting on the end of that type of pass.
Martial plays like Benzema. So you could see if you pair him with someone like Donny who gets forward and scores goals, that could work. But the big problem United have had this season is obviously breaking down teams that just sit back and defend, breaking through lines of defensive defenders. And that's very hard to do without someone who is a genuinely elite creator and someone who can take set pieces. Because United right now got Fred on corners. Fred can't take corners. He's okay at them. Like, everyone at United is okay at corners. Like, they need someone that can take a good set piece. I mean, frankly, the one guy who they should be signing is Christian Eriksen, if he's really at his contract impasse with Spurs. But
I don't think he'll stay in the Prem, though.
I mean, that's the thing. He doesn't want to stay in the Premier League, does he? That was the
given
whole thing.
How tight that top four race is all of a sudden.
And that was the thing this summer, wasn't it? He wanted to leave the Premier League. United were like, should we go for him? But they didn't want to, So anyway, if he's not an option, which, I mean, doesn't seem to be, maybe, Ziyech is right there. Get them both if you have the money, and I'm sure United have the money.
I don't think Ajax is going to sell both of them, though. I
mean, in the same window as well. This is pure speculation, but that's like, to me, that's 150 million. Like, Ajax would easily just say 150 million for two players. Easily.
Because of the timing as well.
They could stand out for that, and Man United would probably go, and that's a lot of money to spend in January when you're maybe waiting for other players to come available. And to avoid spending too much time on Man United, Man City as well, move it on slightly as Van den Beek. To round that off, in 101 games since 2017-18 from midfield, 31 goals and 23 assists. So proves that he does do a bit of both, but maybe the assists come from fewer chances created in the terms that he's always sort of in the box. But the other League Cup game involved, and this was a lot of our coverage on social at least, was based a lot on the battle of the number 10s. James Maddison and Jack Grealish were stealing the headlines, both linked to Man United. I think Miguel Delaney of The Independent did an article on that the week prior, so a lot of build up around those two. Which one would be better suited? Are they even the same player? We put together a comparison video looking at all of their stats, not necessarily saying that they were the exact same type of player, but if you look at their heat map, left-sided final third is red hot from both of them, so they occupy the same space, perhaps do it in different ways. 1-1 was Leicester Aston Villa, Ollie.
Yeah.
Did either of those steal the show in that game at all, or was it one somewhere else?
It was interesting before the game. It was very much centered around those two, and I think it is down to those United links, and it makes sense when you look at the stats. I think Grealish is fourth for chances created in the Premier League. Mm-hmm. Madison's fifth. There's not much to separate them, although interestingly Madison's chances created are pretty much an even split between set pieces and open play, whereas Grealish is a lot more of an open play creator. It was the kind of game that Grealish couldn't really show his best assets going forward, because he was playing off the left, which he has been recently, but Villa didn't have a recognised striker with Wesley out. Anwar El Ghazi sort of played through the middle, but Villa's goal came when he drifted up to the left, which is his favourite position, and crossed it in for Gilbert to score. Villa had three shots, and it was very much after they went in front, they sat back completely, and Leicester dominated the game as you'd expect. I think more so than the battle of the number 10s, as it was sort of build beforehand, it was a battle of the back threes, really. Both teams played three centre-backs, which was interesting. Leicester went with a 3-5-2, so Fuchs came in at left centre-back, Chilwell played left wing-back, and Iose Perez was sort of floating around near Vardy, who was back in the side. Whereas Villa played 3-4-3 to begin with, but as I said, after they went in front, it was pretty much 5-4-1 or 5-5-0. They just sat in two banks.
I think it was Mings and Konsa had 22 clearances between them, both reaching double figures of
and
that.
And Leicester's three centre-backs completed the most amount of passes in their team as well. So, yeah, it was that kind of game, really. But I don't think it really worked for Leicester. It was quite a weird sort of formation change from Brendan Rodgers. Before the game, he said Wilfred Ndidi was injured for what looks like 3 or 4 weeks with a knee problem.
That's a big loss.
It's a massive loss. But the weird thing about that was he's kind of got a ready-made replacement, really, in Hamza Chowdhury, who didn't come in. And Tielemans instead was sort of deployed in this
Rodgers
more
did say
role.
After the game that he made a mistake with his lineup, and he didn't think it was going to be such an aggressive game.
Mm.
And he said he just put the wrong type of player in that holding role. Realised his mistake, of course, then brings Chowdhury on.
Yeah,
that looks
apparent quite quickly. Because, I mean, Tielemans, a big factor behind Leicester's success this season has been the fact that Tielemans and Maddison have had so much freedom because, indeed, he just sweeps up everything behind them. And Tielemans just didn't look like he really knew what he was doing. Pret as well, I'm not sure what kind of player he really is. He's kind of neat and tidy and nice touches. But he doesn't really offer much. Like the first half just bypassed him. And it was interesting. I thought Rodgers would go back to a 4-2-3-1 that he's been playing. But he persisted with the 3-5-2.
In the back against, I think it was their Newcastle, I think.
Yeah, and they've only played it once in the Premier League this season.
And it was Fuchs had the most touches, and he had the most touches again. And I saw a lot of criticism of Ben Chilwell, who shows the difference between left back and left wing back, I think.
Yeah.
If you're a left wing back, you are the primary width. You have to be able to carry the ball and be incisive in your movement. Whereas when you're a fullback, you can be just completely straight line running dynamic, which Chilwell was brilliant at. Get past, cross it in.
This is what I was going to say. I don't think the formation change really suited anyone apart from Ricardo Pereira on the other flank, who is naturally a winger, or started out his career as a winger. And he was probably Leicester's best player. He was just bombing on all the time, getting to the byline and getting crosses in. As you said, Chilwell didn't really suit. Soyuncu playing as a right centre-back was very advanced. And it was weird in the first half that a couple of times he was basically on the edge of Villa's box, like hoisting left-footed crosses into the box. And it's like, what are you doing? Yeah. What are you doing?
And he usually plays on the left side of the partnership when it's 4-2-3-1. So there were loads
of... Yeah, he looked like a proper square peg round hole.
Almost like Rodgers is not trying too hard, but it's like, right... Because I remember when he went to the Diamond, he was like, oh, we've been working on that. And it was used to counter a specific team setup. And now he's tried to develop another one, but this one hasn't really had
the same
success.
This is another thing, though, with playing two up front. I thought Iozo was actually quite good, quite effective and worked hard. But I do think that Vardy just thrives playing on his own through the middle. Vardy still had three chances. Forced Nyland into a save a couple of times and put one narrowly wide. And they were all very much quintessential Vardy chances, making that run from middle to inside channel either side and getting shots off quickly.
And there's more channels when you play three at the back, isn't there? Because technically there's one between the fullback as well as the three centre-backs. Calls for Pepe Reina's transfer to Aston Villa to be cancelled after Nyland's performance.
Yeah, it was great.
But
it was really, really solid.
Really strong performance. And again, Aston Villa have been struck by those two serious injuries. You already mentioned Wesley. Mm. They'll be looking to definitely get a centre-forward in because I think Gilbert's goal was their only shot on target, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. They hit the bar through Konsa just on the just before half time, which would have probably not changed things really, because Villa just sat in the whole second half anyway, and it was literally attack via defence for that whole second half. But Leicester, the goal was always going to come, and Iheanacho, to be fair to Rodgers, he made two changes, and they both paid off brilliantly. Chowdhury, as we mentioned, on the ball was very crisp, moved it really well. I think he completed 95% of his passes. So Tielemans was in that position to do that. Chowdhury did that anyway. And he also made three tackles and he won the ball off Douglas Luiz in the lead up to the goal. And Iheanacho finished it really well. Mm. I was looking as well after. I mean, his record against Villa, he's got 5-5 against Villa and two assists as well. So for some reason, he loves playing against Villa.
There's a lot of strikers he like playing against Villa.
And he loves the cups because obviously at Man City, you play in the cups.
I think he got a hat-trick against Villa for City. Yeah.
And he's got, I think it's like 16 goals, 25 games or something like that. And that's not including any assists he might have picked up. So he loves it. And it was obviously at the King Power as well. So on the face of it, decent result for Aston Villa. Do you think?
Definitely. Yeah,
looking
really,
ahead
really
to
good.
That one, we said that the Man City one is maybe written off. Do you think Aston Villa can get anything?
Well, it depends what business Villa managed to do before the second leg, because I think it was a great result for them, and there was a lot of positives there for them, because recently their form has been very up and down. They obviously got that really big result against Burnley last time out in the Premier League, but defensively, they were really, really resilient. And I think the return of Tyrone Mings is no coincidence in that. And he came back for the Burnley game and they kept Burnley out for 80 minutes. And again, against same thing against Leicester last night, it kept them out for 80 minutes. They eventually got through, but it was only through an individual error from Douglas Luiz that Leicester scored. He made a huge difference, but it's just in that top end. Without, I mean, Wesley hasn't been prolific, but he gives them a focal point.
Yeah.
They didn't have that at all last
night. You would
have
thought that like that would have alleviated some of the pressure.
Yeah,
because they just spent the whole second half defending.
Their only get out was giving it to Grealish, and he would win fouls.
That's what I was about to bring up. So again, just to focus back onto that comparison, you mentioned Ziyech as a creator that Man United once signed. They may not be going for that one because they may be waiting for Grealish or Maddison.
Yeah,
and that game was a microcosm of both of the seasons of those two players, because James Maddison for Leicester, the most crosses, 15. Most shots, 8. 2 shots on target, which was the joint most. Not great accuracy, but second most touches.
They were
100
both from
touches.
Like 6 yard box as well, those shots, which isn't what you'd associate him with.
He created the most chances, and 95.4% passing accuracy of an attacking midfielder. Showed why he's being considered as one of the sort of the brightest English number 10s, and showed his ability. Mo, you mentioned again set piece wise, and you mentioned his split of chances created. Man United, I think, would lean towards Maddison if they were going to.
I think he's the one that makes the most sense, but Grealish, if Villa go down, is obviously going to be more gettable than Maddison.
I mean, Grealish is a hero, but he's more like, I would say, more like what United currently have in terms of a player, whereas Maddison has something, is different. You know, he's set pieces, he's crossing, he's more genuine chance creation, and he hits free kicks, he looks like Beckham. What do you want?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, come on.
I think in a few years as well, he might be able to control games as well. He can't quite do that at the minute, but I think, given in a big side with better players around him, I'm not saying United have better players than Leicester at the moment, but given if they invest properly, then he would have a platform, I think,
I was going to say the one thing, reason why you would pursue Donny ahead of Ziyech right now is if your eye is on Sancho or Maddison or Grealish for the summer, then you're thinking we'll get, because then that pairs quite well, because then you've got a creative player like that, and then you've got Donny scoring goals, so that makes a little more sense. And of course, Van de Beek and Martial work well as well, so
that's what I meant about the you saying go and get Ziyech and Donny van de Beek. The criticism of Man United is you never have a plan. A plan. Maybe van de Beek is like part one.
Play Maddison as a 10, we've written
the season off, let's start building. And then Jack Grealish, as you mentioned, 7 fouls, 1 on the pitch.
I mean,
four more than any other player.
You just know what's coming. As soon as he gets the ball and there's like, and Villa are under pressure, he just buys fouls so easily.
And it's like it's one of those sort of pseudo target men, isn't it? That gives you time. Having a player that's able to win fouls like that.
It's Deco-esque.
And 20 more fouls won than any other player in Europe this season.
They're all really soft as well.
They are like, soft.
He doesn't usually get hacked. It's
intelligent though, isn't it?
And he puts
his body in front, and once he's got
exactly
one of those calves in front of the ball, then you can't get through it. The low socks are almost like a red towel for
like a moth to
a flag. Yeah. So attracting a lot of interest and a lot of fouls, Jack Grealish.
I mean, they've got one cap between him, 34 minutes. Which,
Gareth Southgate was there last night, wasn't he, as well?
Yeah, well,
I think
he would love them both.
Because on the video, a lot of the comments were, what about Mason Mount? What about Mason Mount? And the one thing you would say in Mason Mount's defence as well, one, he's younger than both. So for him to be in the consideration is really impressive anyway. And also plays in the quote-unquote better side, and again plays a completely different role.
Well, he's playing Champions League football.
Yeah, and Mason Mount is there. Chelsea's Van der Beek. If you look at just shots, does get a lot of assists, but not necessarily loads of chances created. Whereas these two are considered the chief playmakers of each side. And the one other player that's sort of fitting into this discussion, and when you're looking at all the stats,
here we go,
is Buendia for Norwich. And I wanted to focus more on that, but we've spent a lot of time. There's only so many players we can analyse on one podcast, so he might be for another episode. But Emi Buendia is dominating top three of all of the stats that you love to look at.
Some clever side is going to pick him up for like 20 million when Norwich go down. Norwich, it's going
to
be.
I don't think you even have to be clever at them. At the point.
If we've identified it,
if I've managed to pick it out, then you'd hope there are some analysts in other football clubs that can notice it as well. In the second section of the podcast, we are going to be picking out 3 Premier League matches you should watch and telling you why, and then based on the predictions that have been brought up, we'll be putting this into our Bet Ball accumulator at the end of the podcast, which you can get from clicking on the link in the podcast description. And completely at random, definitely, Ollie, I'm going to start with you. Which game have you picked out to watch this weekend?
Spurs v Liverpool on Saturday evening, I think.
Yep, half five.
Yeah.
That's when you can watch it.
Stick your teeth into that. Yeah, probably the biggest game of the weekend.
Why should people be sticking their teeth into it?
Well, there's plenty of reasons. I'm just going to reel off some stats first off so we can get a little feel about what this game is going to be like. So
get to know the game.
Yeah, exactly.
Get to know the fixture.
This is all you need to know. Spurs have won one of their last 14 Premier League matches against Liverpool, 4-1 in October 2017. They battered Liverpool, and that was basically the game that convinced Klopp to sign Van Dijk.
I think Lovren got substituted in like 20 minutes in that game.
Yeah. Yeah, they absolutely battered them. Since then, Liverpool have destroyed Spurs. Mourinho has won 2 of his 10 games against Jurgen Klopp. Remember the Dortmund Real Madrid Champions League games?
Have you got draws for those though? Because I imagine
not yet, but I will have a look. I'll have a look if you will.
Stitched him up there.
Sorry.
And finally, Spurs have the lowest number of clean sheets in the Premier League this season, alongside Norwich City. So everything is pointing towards a convincing Liverpool victory. So yeah, it's going to be very interesting. I mean, Mourinho could roll back the years and do a Mourinho and somehow get a result when no one expects Spurs to, but I don't really think that's going to happen. The recent evidence doesn't suggest that Spurs are going to be capable of that, particularly given selection issues at the moment.
Yeah.
It's going to be very interesting to see what he does. He played played a back three against Middlesbrough in the FA Cup. He played a very strong team against Middlesbrough to win.
And still let my prediction come true.
They didn't.
The thing is, I don't know if he necessarily had to, but his alternative was to play quite an inexperienced team.
Yeah.
You're looking at that bench, it didn't look... No. It looks like Spurs have got depth issues again.
It's a weird one because a lot of Spurs fans, when Mourinho came in, were like, oh, great, we've got a manager who knows how to win things. And then as soon as he picks a really strong team in an FA Cup tie, they're like, why is he picking a strong team? We're playing Liverpool in a few days. It's like, well, what do you want?
Because they don't know how to win things.
Yeah. But I mean, the worrying thing is he picked such a strong team and they should have lost. I mean, they didn't play very well. And yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what he does. He's played Sessegnon as a left wing back recently, Aurier as a right wing back. And it makes sense in a certain way because Vertonghen and Alderweireld have both been quite shaky this season. So if you put Sanchez with them, at least you've got a quick centre back who can, I mean, those three can sort of man mark Liverpool's front three. And then you alleviate Sessegnon and Aurier's defensive deficiencies by playing them a little bit further up. But what he does in midfield and attack is going to be really interesting. There's news a couple of days ago that Sissoko's out until April. Well, April at the earliest with a knee injury. Spurs have already got injuries in that area, so it's going to be interesting to see who he picks. And obviously Kane is absent as well up front. I think the best solution that Spurs could go for in this game, which they 100% won't, is to do a Bielsa 3-3-2-2, which I think would be great because Mourinho was complaining a lot about Son and Lucas the other day, saying they're not strikers. I think if you played Son and Ali up front, Lo Celso and Eriksen behind them, Sessegnon wing back, Aurier wing back, Dyer as a sort of hatchet man in front of the back three, I think that's probably the best way that Spurs can go, but he's not going to do that. So I think Liverpool will just fly through Spurs.
I think selection issues could make this a more difficult fixture for Liverpool.
Because they can't prepare for it.
Because if you look back to the game that denied Liverpool the title, arguably, in 2013-14, I think Mourinho played... I'm talking about the game at, I think, Stamford Bridge, the Gerrard slip game.
I was going to say, there's so many games that have denied Liverpool the title. You needed to clarify.
Yeah, all of them. I think
Thomas Callas
played shackled Luis Suarez, or probably not shackled him on his own, but was among several defenders who did a job on that. And essentially, what these selection issues might do is they might give Jose Mourinho a license to park the bus for the first time, really, at Spurs. I've struggled to predict what Jose Mourinho will do with regards to his lineup for this one. We were talking off air, and maybe Jan Vertonghen left back if he wants to really shore up that side.
If he goes for a back four, that's the only real option.
Or go for a back three / back five.
I mean, he could do what Villa did and literally just play a back five and sit in. But considering Spurs are at home and are technically a top four, top six club. That would be quite a
He's not been afraid to do it. He wasn't afraid to do it at Man United, and Klopp couldn't beat Man United at Old Trafford.
Yeah,
we're doing it. So
I think
it's the catch 22, isn't it? Is do Spurs in this game? Liverpool are the clear and obvious best team in the league. Do you have to hold your hands up and say we're not there yet, but we're going to make it as difficult as possible for you to beat us? Or do you say they're the best? Let's try and play how we perceive our best football to be and see what happens. If it's 7-0, then we're clearly 7-0 worse off.
After that Old Trafford game, the Solskjaer took charge of where Liverpool dropped points, the only game in which they've dropped points this season. Jurgen Klopp came out and said that every time they go to Old Trafford, Man United just play defensively. And Jose Mourinho was in the Sky Sports studio, gave his analysis of the game, during which he advocated for Manchester United playing in such a way. His quotes were, Jurgen Klopp's moaning, I'm paraphrasing, by the way, just to get myself out of trouble.
His quotes were,
his indirect quotes were, like, Jurgen Klopp's moaning, he didn't like the menu, he wanted meat and he got fish. I think he said something like that. Yeah. And so, I mean, it wouldn't be too surprising, therefore, to see him adopt a similar style in this game with Spurs, especially given that he's not been at the club long. Pre-match press conference said, look at, Jurgen Klopp's been able to make Liverpool this good because he's had 4 years there, in basically a reverse highlighting of the fact that he needs to be given time.
Yeah, that, because if you remember back to when he first took over at Chelsea, and the start of that season, obviously Arsenal were the Invincibles, and they were both going for like tit for tat. Like Mourinho's team, they'd win, like they'd 0-0, they'd 1-0, 2-0, 1-0, and then Arsenal winning like 6-0, 5-0, 4-0, and everyone's like, oh, why aren't you scoring us at Arsenal? And he said something like, Arsenal are a fully grown adult, I've still got a baby of a team here. You know, they've been together for a few months. I think he could do the same thing with Spurs in this game, especially, and even going forward, frankly. Look, he's got Son is great in transition. Lucas is great in transition. Dele Alli can hold the ball up, he's great in transition. I think that's your front three, front three, front two, with Dele going from midfield to attack. Park the bus. They've got no chance. If they try and play Liverpool at a football match, they're going to get killed. There's no chance they can even hope to play Liverpool at a football match. Park the bus, sit Sessegnon as a left winger, sit him on Trent. Just say, look, just follow him everywhere. Play Vertonghen left back, whatever you want to do. 4-4-2. Dele and Son up front. And then just hit Dele with the long balls if you can. He'll win a few in the air, especially if he targets Gomez. If Gomez plays and Matip doesn't. If Matip plays, he could challenge Matip in the air. Not Matip, Gomez in the air. And then just run Son off him. And that's the only chance they've got. Run Son into the channels behind the fullbacks. They're not going to beat Liverpool in a football match. They'll get killed. Try and Mourinho it. Old school
remember
Mourinho.
Liverpool as well. Couldn't keep a clean sheet for Toffee at the beginning of the season. Six in a row, I think, now.
Five in the Premier League,
in the Premier League, which is the most since Rafa.
Yeah, 2007.
So
Adrian masterclass at the weekend.
All of a sudden...
it became old David De Gea saving
up. I was
going to
say it was all foot, mainly because Everton were just kicking it. And we got a first row view at that, because if you didn't see, we were behind the scenes with the FA Cup with BBC Sport. So a couple of articles already gone out. Gary Lineker talking about Jordan Henderson and also talking about Leicester and their why they should keep people like Madison and their project they can build on. So if you haven't seen those, make sure to check those out. Liverpool all of a sudden back to that team that don't concede goals, and they've got the African player of the year scoring them at the other end.
They've kept 8 clean sheets across all competitions over the 12 games since Fabinho's injury, which was supposed to completely derail their season defensively, albeit, as you noted just a moment ago, they weren't up to their old levels defensively during the initial stages of the current campaign. Henderson has started in some kind of holding position in all but one of those 8 games in which they've kept clean sheets. That was Sunday's 1-0 win over Everton, in which he was, of course, rested. And I know when we posted this article regarding whether Henderson, why is Henderson so underrated, a lot of people were up sideways passes and a perceived negative style of play. But during that same period, Henderson has averaged more passes into the final third per 90 minutes than any other Premier League player to have started at least one game. And only Kevin De Bruyne and Emi Buendia have created more of what Opta defined big chances.
Yeah, that's a weird thing to say about Henderson. Like, sideways passes is not, if he has a weakness, it's not sideways passes.
That period of time where Klopp was figuring out the style and when it was a bit more reserved, and they were clearly, he was making a lot of passes and they weren't. But Gary Lineker said, didn't he? He's being, or was it Leon Osborne?
I think Gary Lineker said he was being more forthright in his passing. Yeah. And I think it's not necessarily it's the side
being
of his passing.
Some,
he did previously have a, you might criticise him for a tendency to linger on the ball a little bit too long and not play it forward straight away. I think Liverpool have on paper won the midfield battle, which is not something you might have said at the start of this season going into a game away at Spurs, purely because, I mean, like, we're all saying Mourinho should park the bus in this one, but
Spurs
does he
have the midfielders to really do
does
it?
Does he have the midfielders to do it?
I mean,
Dyer's fit, right?
He doesn't fancy Winks at all. Winks got hooked again against Borough 10 minutes into the second half. He was on a yellow, so maybe that played a part, but Mourinho just obviously doesn't fancy him, which I think everyone sort of predicted beforehand he might be the fall guy. But yeah, as we were saying, Dyer, he praised Lo Celso and Lamella, actually. They both came on 10 minutes into the second half. He's not really used Lo Celso at all. But he did praise him for his impact off the bench. So maybe he could get a start. The problem for Spurs is both Pochettino and Mourinho have tried to phase out Christian Eriksen and develop the team and move on, and they've both had to just bring him back in slowly. Because Eriksen's his best game of the season was the Norwich game. Yeah,
unique as well, relative to the other players. Yeah. So if he doesn't play, then you don't have that sort of player.
The thing is, Ndombele, we don't know if he's going to be fit or not. Mm. He's another one that Mourinho's been talking about. But if he's not fit, there's no Ndombele, there's no Sissoko either. So those two have the energy to sort of press Liverpool and get in their faces, and if those two aren't there, then
not just the energy. I mean, I think Ndombele is probably there. I mean, behind Eriksen, he's the best passer as well. Yeah. Like, this is the thing. I mean, again, and I'm a big proponent of criticizing Mourinho, but you have to feel for him in a way, because I mean, he's not had Ndombele basically this whole time at Spurs. That by far Spurs is the best midfielder, and
we saw that against Norwich.
Yeah, and then Sissoko is who is pure Mourinho as a player. Now he's injured, seriously injured. I mean, yeah, like that's why I say park the bus, because I mean this sounds ridiculous. You don't have to be necessarily a great player to park the bus. You just have to be physically, capable.
And to be fair, Eriksen does put in yards as well. He does run.
I was going
to
say Lamella is sort of a
Lamella is
held
Mourinho.
Up as a sort of
he's a perfect Mourinho.
Maybe it's the way he tears about and just kicks people
and gets his yellow card and then just holds off a little bit.
He strikes you as that player that is putting in a shift because he makes a lot of tackles and some of them are bad. So I don't know if that's me being seduced by that.
He also scores Rabona goals on Kylian Mbappe.
Why don't slander the wonder kid on this?
Basically, just Lamella right wing, Sessegnon left wing, and just tell him to sit on Trent, and then, or even maybe Lamella left wing, and just say, look, sit on Trent. Don't let him get forward, because you can cut him off. You can cut off a lot of Liverpool's creativity. Four midfield, just sit deep, two blocks of fours, tell Liverpool to break you down. They probably will, because they're really good.
I don't know if they're necessarily going to be having to withstand waves and waves of attack.
No, Liverpool are very considered, aren't they?
They tend to be quite patient, and Klopp doesn't really let loose the shackles in these away games to big six sides. They've only played two this season. One was the 1-1 draw with Manchester United. The other was a 2-1 win over Chelsea, in which they weren't overwhelmingly dominant.
Yeah.
Last season, they won only one of their big six games away. That was against Spurs, though, it should be said.
Pochettino's Spurs.
The others ended in draws, and of course the 2-1 defeat to Manchester City. I think my prediction for this one with regards to BetBull is for the halftime result to be 0-0. Yeah. And I was looking into the number of goals that Liverpool score in away games in the first half of fixtures, just because I had this idea that they tend to manage games in quite a sort of in not a very top-heavy manner, in which they'll sort of see how the game pans out, and then if they need to,
kick it long.
Go up through the gears.
go up through
the gears in the second half. Yeah. And Liverpool have scored 8 first-half goals away from home in the Premier League this season, while they've scored 12 in the second half. So that's 50% more. And they've averaged 2 first-half shots on target. per away match in the competition. And when you look at the second half of matches, that jumps up to three by a third. So that's my prediction for this one. I think it'll be 0-0 at half time, and I think everyone will be getting on at Henderson for not doing enough, doing too many sideways passes. But then I think Liverpool will be able
to win the kind of game where I can see Bobby Firmino show up. There was some late little goal, half chance, and he'll just tuck it away.
He hasn't scored at Anfield yet, so away games, if he is going to score one, he would be your person to pick out of those front three. Salah and Mane do it at Anfield.
But Mane, I was quite surprised at this. So Mane's got 11 goals this season, Salah's got 10 in the league, that is. Four of Mane's have been from away from home, and only one of Salah's has been away from home. So
exactly.
Mane is probably the one to watch. But yeah, Firmino... kind of just goes through these little phases, doesn't he? Yeah. These little patches of form. So,
what's your? And I'll just flag, pick a game to watch. This one, because Mourinho is going to defend. They're really exciting. What are your predictions though for it, Ollie? On that one.
Following on from that, I'm predicting Liverpool to win by 2 or 3.
Oh, so that is why you should watch.
You say that, but I think the more. This game would be boring if Liverpool just steamrolled them in the first half. If Mourinho pulls off a defensive performance that frustrates Liverpool, then you'll get people going, oh, is the title so done and dusted?
I think it's more likely to be to win by two. I think the market is to win by 2 or 3.
Cool.
But I think I can see it being Liverpool going 2-0 up, Spurs getting one back, really pushing on, and then getting done on the counter.
Trent, 90-yard cross onto Bobby Firmino's head.
Yeah.
Second match to watch, Mohamed Butt.
Yeah,
we come to you.
Well, you won't let me pick Barcelona, so
because they're not in the Premier League. Yeah,
that's the joke, Jake.
Which
would
probably be why.
Yes. No, I picked 19th versus 18th in Bournemouth versus Watford because it's a proper relegation like scrap, and also it's like just the numbers are mad. So basically, Watford are playing well now. They're pointing Nigel Pearson, which everyone was wondering, is that going to work? And he's done very well. They look much better. They've won 3 of the last 4 in the Premier League. They drew, obviously, in the Cup at the weekend. They're playing more energy and drive. And I mean, you really don't want to be this reductive and, you know, your dad kind of thing, but they are just trying more. They're really putting a shift now. And that has actually helped, just the increased effort, physical effort on the pitch. And the return of Deeney has helped. I think Troy Deeney coming back has been a huge thing as well. But looking at the numbers of this game, the reason you should watch this game is because I think Watford are going to kill Bournemouth. You look at the game. So Watford, since Pearson's been in charge, 6th of December, 8 goals, that's 8th in the Premier League, 47 chances created, that's 12th, 43 shots, that's 16th, so not that great, but they've got an 18.6% conversion, which is 3rd. They've conceded just 4 goals, which only Liverpool have conceded less than that in the time, and they've created 8 big chances, right? That's impressive. Bournemouth, they've scored twice, that's the last in the Premier League. They've created 31 chances, that's last. They've got 4 big, that's 19th. 24 shots, last. 8.33 conversion rate, 19th. 11 conceded, 19th. They're awful. They're playing awful right now. And part of that is because Nathan Aki's not there, because the fours are just misfiring. And, it's unfortunate as well. You never want to see it happen. Eddie Hassan's like a decent bloke and everything. But they're not playing well. They look really... They've always been a yo-yo kind of side. You never know which one's going to turn up because they play a sort of open, expansive style. But usually they have enough goals and firepower to get themselves out of trouble. And they're not that bad at the back that... you think, oh, they're going to be a disaster because Ake's very good. He's not there now. He's injured. And they look so porous. Anytime they're attacking, they just think they're going to score. You know, Watford's run is, they're playing so well now under Pearson. They're staying in such a groove that you just almost can't see Bournemouth coping with them. Mm-hmm. And I mean, look, the only worry for Watford is how long is it going to last? Because obviously you get new manager bounce and then you always wonder how long is it going to last?
The surrendering that 3-goal lead in the FA Cup
could
represent a psychological blow.
They needed to get someone sent off earlier.
It could be. I mean, and you look at it though, right? So like they've got 8 goals, which is 8th in the Premier League, but then they've only had 43 shots, 16. So they're converting things, 18.6% conversion. That's very high. Well, not very high, but it's high. Mm. It's an impressive conversion rate. Can they sustain that with the players that they have? Is the worry about it. I mean, it's not quite less that Vardy's scoring with like half his shots or whatever it is, but it's a high conversion rate. And the XG, for example, over that period is 6.55, right? That's about mid-table. Their expected goals against is 7.03. But obviously, the XG is from open play, so it doesn't take account two set-piece goals are scored. But they're putting up mid-table-ish numbers, right? So they're probably not going to keep playing as well as they are playing. The only worry for Leicester is can they keep... Can they pick up enough points while they're hot like this right now? And to that end, I think, because like Wilson, I think throwing away a 3-goal lead in the FA Cup is huge. It could be a big deflator. they've got a lucky, they've got a good game coming up next in the Bournemouth. I think if they can smash Bournemouth, they'll get their mojo back. Maybe go on to win a couple more. Yeah. Keep the thing going. If they don't, I would say even if they just sneak a win, if they don't really get over Bournemouth and properly take advantage of them, they could be in trouble, because it could be their numbers are showing that they're overperforming a little bit. And with the players they're not overflowing with talent, shall we say. They've got some talented players.
I think
Sarr flanking Deeney now is quite a...
Pearson's been playing Doucouré sort of as a 10, but not as like a creative 10, but further up the pitch, which has also made a difference. But yeah, as you said, Sarr, similar to Pepe, I think both came from Ligue 1 with big reputations for being dribbly players off the right and scoring goals, and they had a slow start, but he's coming into his own now. And De La Feu is having his patch of form when he's red hot
in January. That's the worry, is we're worrying about how long is that going to last for De La Feu, because he is a notoriously streaky player in terms of his form. And he is great when he's on. He's magnificent when he's on. But he doesn't always stay on for the whole time. I think it's a really good chance for Watford to like, sort of put their season in the right track, get a few more points, because if they can pick up enough points while they're hot and climb out of the relegation zone, or at least far enough away from it that it's not like one loss sends them back into the bottom three, then I think their numbers will tail off and they'll be a bit more like mediocre, mid-level, mid-table.
This is their must-win game. If they win this game, they'll obviously go above Bournemouth, who they're 1 point behind, but they'll also go above Aston Villa, who host Manchester City. So this could be the week where a win takes them out of the relegation zone.
Yeah.
And they looked toast when Pearson came, and they were rooted to the bottom of the table. I think had fewer than 10 points.
They had one win before Pearson.
Yeah. I think a lot of people sort of scoffed at that appointment, but then Pearson was the one that masterminded Leicester's great escape and obviously went on to win the Premier League. And he was also, I think I'm right in saying, he was the assistant manager to Brian Robson when West Brom did it, or first team coach or something. He was on the staff anyway.
Yeah, basically Pearson knows how to survive. Like there are managers, and I think Pearson is going to be one of them, that make their living off knowing how to David Moyes is another one, Sam Allardyce, these guys who make their living off, I know how to survive relegation, I know how to get a team organised, and I get them playing well. And can he evolve from that? Can he move forward from that? I don't know, we'll see. I mean, Roy Hodgson kind of has now. Palace are like a solid mid-table team. You wouldn't want to mess with them on their day. So Pearson could do the same at Watford. Watford have shown they're not shy of actually buying players.
Well, their recruitment's actually one of the more intelligent in the Premier League, because they snap up those 18-year-olds that may not even play for the club, but they can turn 25 million without anyone actually noticing. Luca Bacchio did it. Scored a hat-trick against Bayern Munich in the Bundesliga last season.
Yeah.
Never played for Watford, but they sold him for 25 million.
Joao Pedro.
Yeah, Joao Pedro's just come from Fluminense, which is where they got Richarlison as well. Yeah. Another really exciting Brazilian player. Everyone thinks all of a sudden they've got this. They've got Cucho Hernandez that hasn't even played for them yet. One of the biggest stars. Peñaranda. Venezuela Under-20 World Cup
Their recruitment is very, very smart. But the one thing they've decided not to do for some reason over the past few windows is buy a centre-back. Cabasele is actually, his return has been important for them, although he keeps getting sent off, but when he does play he's
but,
pretty solid.
But Watford, there was three consecutive games of getting a red card, and Tranmere was the first one they had won. So Pereira saving it for the 89th minute.
It was his birthday, I think, this week, so that's why he got sent off.
It's a classic Christmas one.
Eric Lamella and Gazzaniga around his house this week.
So any predictions, but you've sounded out Watford hammering, but you forgot that Dominic Solanke has scored his first goal for Bournemouth now.
That's true.
So here comes the
after how many games?
Here comes the wave. I think it's 27.
Yeah, so here we go. With the in mind that Dominic Solanke has scored his first goal. 4-1 Watford.
4-1.
Wow.
Give us a chance for this
to come in again. 4-1.
All right, 3-1 then, fine.
I'd quite like to quickly make the point, because I hadn't really realised it. Well, I had kind of realised it previously in the season, but I think the quality of the relegation battle this season is quite a bit higher than certainly last season, wherein I think you had Huddersfield Town on 10 points rooted to the bottom of the table. Norwich are 4 points ahead of what they managed by this stage last season on 14 points, but they had that glorious win against Manchester City, and they've been playing. They've had the Teemu Pukki surge that we all remember was a narratorial thread at the start of the season. And they've played in quite a nice, pleasing to watch style of play. And
they've got Emiliano Buendia. And The final game which you should watch this weekend is actually the first Premier League match that is on. It is Crystal Palace versus Arsenal. And it takes premium importance because under Unai Emery, Arsenal never beat Crystal Palace. In fact, Unai Emery has only ever played Man City and Recreativo Huelva more times without winning than Roy Hodgson's Crystal Palace. So Mikel Arteta has the chance to cement the change that has been made at Arsenal with a potential victory at Selhurst Park, which is notoriously a difficult place to go or at least score goals. I was going to just rattle through what we've seen from Mikel Arteta's first few games so far. There has been a pattern of sorts, maybe only four games, three of which have been at home. So perhaps you can't really apply any of it to this game at Selhurst Park. But basically, Unai Emery was known as this second half FC, making his double changes at halftime and redoing his team when he was getting his team selection wrong and getting results because of it. Arteta's actually been the inverse. Arsenal's first halves under Arteta have been impressive. At home against Man United, 7 shots to 2 with 58% possession. In the second half, 3 shots to 6 and 39% possession. Before that against Chelsea, 5 shots to 3 in the first half, 47% possession. But this was the one before Man United, so they were even less fit than than David Luiz admitted after the Man United win. Because in the second half, 2 shots to 10 and 37% possession. Oddly enough, it took a championship team to invert this paradigm again, and Leeds United played Arsenal off the park in the FA Cup. Ollie mentioned Jose Mourinho should be employing a Marcelo Bielsa style, maybe, against Liverpool. I think he would lap it up if they could play like Leeds did against Arsenal. Calvin Phillips in particular, proving why people are probably going to be looking at him, even if Leeds do make... actually get promoted again this season. Because in the first half, 3 shots from Arsenal, 15 for Leeds, 5 of which were on target, and they only had 37% possession.
And they hit the bar.
Yeah, exactly, and they hit the bar. And then in the second half, though, Arsenal 13 to 3 shots, completely inverse, 49% possession again, but they got their winner. So basically, what we can see from Arsenal at the moment is that they don't have the fitness or maybe the grasp on the tactics to employ Mikel Arteta's philosophy for the whole 90 minutes yet. But when they do find their rhythm, there have been bursts in which they're showing and proving that they have improved. Especially Mesut Ozil playing most of these minutes has been praised for not only his ability on the ball, which is a given, I think covered the most distance against Man United, which finally is the one to silence the critics, because that was usually the stat that was thrown against him. So even Mesut Ozil was running around under Mikel Arteta. But they faced the team which perhaps started Unai Emery's downfall as well, because it was a home game against Crystal Palace in which Wilfried Zaha put himself in the shop window to Unai Emery at least. Incredible display in a 3-2 win. Again, Mustafi nightmares of that performance. David Luiz is now in, but there's a stat to suggest, and this is my bet ball accumulator here. I don't know if we'll be able to do exactly a penalty being given, but since 2016-17 in the Premier League, Wilfried Zaha himself has won 12 penalties, which is the joint most alongside Raheem Sterling. Arsenal have conceded 28 penalties in that time, which is the most, and Granit Xhaka himself is top of that list with 5. So all signs point towards a penalty being won by Wilfried Zaha in this game.
From Granit Xhaka.
And considering, again, the links to other clubs have arisen in January, he seems the sort of player that we've seen. He's very happy to stay at Crystal Palace and despite all these rumours, has performed valiantly for them. But it could be another chance to remind people that the 80 million price tag that's been bandied about and the fact that he wants to play Champions League football, a chance to prove against a perceived top side, again, I know Arsenal are far from it in the league table, could be the cause of Mikel Arteta's downfall and repeating the mistakes that Unai Emery, or not the mistakes, but failing to clear the obstacle that Unai Emery never cleared as Arsenal manager. And the one thing about Wilfried Zaha, and this is more based on him and the transfer rumours, is that he is, in fact, there are two players statistically that rely on a player as much as Crystal Palace rely on Wilfried Zaha, attacking wise. In terms of dribbles completed, touches inside the opposition box, fouls won, goals, chances created, and total touches, so how much they're seeing the ball. Wilfried Zaha and Jack Grealish are the only two players in the Premier League that contribute at least 10% of each of those. And when I told Ollie this off air, he was not impressed at all, saying to me that 10% isn't everything.
I think his eyebrow turned into a question mark.
Yeah, isn't a high number at all. But that's surely even more encouraging, because it's not even that high. And to achieve 10%, it's not like there's a list of 50 players that have done this, Ollie. Two players, and we spoke about Aston Villa's reliance on Jack Grealish, the fact they use him. Jack, take us up the pitch. Jack, score us a goal. Jack, assist a goal. Crystal Palace have been like this with Wilfried Zaha for the past three seasons, perhaps. And those percentages are just for this season. I imagine there'd be more so in other seasons, because Jordan Ayew this season has come in and shouldered some of the goal-scoring burden. Again, I think we mentioned his incredible solo goal to win the game.
It was so good.
Andros Townsend was sometimes the partner in crime on the other side for Zaha when it wasn't just him scoring a spectacular goal against Man City, the example. But Crystal Palace rely on Wilfried Zaha. He's got the exact skill set that Arsenal have notoriously struggled against, someone that is incredible at carrying the ball, direct, dynamic. If you look at goals Arsenal concede, their centre-backs seem to run away from forwards that carry the ball, and Wilfried Zaha carries the ball, and Ayew's proved that he can carry the ball. So I'm not sure of the actual result, because, as I said, Arteta's games have been at home. It was the first game against Bournemouth, which was Arsenal had produced a lot of shots, but as Mo alluded to earlier, Bournemouth are not a fantastic team at the current moment. So that draw was perhaps a bad result, relatively. And based on the home games against Chelsea, against Man United, teams that were expected to match Arsenal, and then Leeds, who, above all else, dominated the most possession against Arsenal in these games, Crystal Palace will be a completely different game. I'm not sure how Arteta will approach it. I imagine Pepe, Lacazette, Aubameyang will all start, and they'll be using Lacazette as the foil, the hold-up play. Yet to score, but Arteta's been really impressed with him. I think we did a news line about him echoing Arsene Wenger's analysis of Lacazette liked. That was quite a nice headline.
He's done a lot of very... Yeah, he looks like Luis Suarez. He brings his teammates into play really, really well.
He even kicked a Leeds player as well the other day.
Yeah, exactly. Proper Suarez.
And with people like Granit Xhaka turning a leaf, there's still rumoured that Jurgen Klinsmann wants him at Hertha Berlin, but Arteta clearly wanted him as well, and recent performances have suggested that Granit Xhaka looks to be enjoying
role. He said he's told the club not to accept any bids for Xhaka.
Good, because on his day, and when used in correct circumstances, Granit Xhaka has proven to be picked by every manager that's had him anyway. So despite some deficiencies, he's still one of Arsenal's better midfielders. And now Lucas Torreira has been deployed next to him in a really positive way.
That reminds me of the commentary during Man United at Arsenal, where the commentators were just astounded. Like, he's playing at the base of midfield. He's doing really well with Torreira. And I was like, did you not watch the World Cup? Yeah. He's really good there.
Or even at the start, Xhaka and Torreira as a double pivot. The Liverpool game, top six, you mentioned the draws away. Granit Xhaka and Lucas Torreira, really strong game. I think that prompted me to write a video script about Lucas Torreira being the Arsenal midfielder Arsenal had been looking for so long.
I mean, I compared him to King.
That aged terribly, but you should watch it, because Arteta has the chance to really cement his place as the new age Arsenal manager by doing something that Unai Emery could never do. And to finish this week's Squawker Talk, a football podcast sponsored by BetBull.com, we are going to have a bit of fun. And this week's fun takes the form of pretending or making up or not making up stats about La Liga.
Way.
I was going to say no, but cheers. But he did actually cheer, so it works perfectly. So if you've not listened to this section before, we are playing a completely original game in which someone will say a stat, and this week it will be based on La Liga, and the rest of us have to decide whether it is true or false. you get a point if you deceive correctly everyone else, and the person with the most points wins.
Yeah.
We'll start with you, Mo.
Go on, then.
Senor La Liga.
Senor La Liga. Barcelona have scored 49 goals this season. That's the most in La Liga. But they've done this with just 176 shots, which means they've taken less shots than 12th place Osasuna, who have 199.
Cool. That's cool. A meaty.
That was relatively snappy from that, actually.
Ollie, you can go first.
I think it is true.
False.
It's true.
Oh, oof, I thought it was going to be a different team. Yeah. I thought it was going to be like nearly true, but not. So 2 points for you. Fantastic.
Good start.
Ollie.
Do you remember Roberto Soldado of Tottenham Hotspur fame?
Hey. Yes.
Well, I was stunned to find out.
True. I do remember him.
I was stunned to find out that he's been the most booked player in La Liga this season.
It's true.
Or was he?
Oh,
it's true.
Mo's going straight in. I'll say true.
False. Because I think you've oversold it.
It is false. Mubarak Wakaso has been booked 10 times. Yeah. Roberto Soldado is in a huddle of players on eight.
Eight?
Which is seems a lot. Eight
he's,
yellows.
He's got angry. No, he has more bookings than goals. That's what I was thinking.
He's got four times as many bookings as goals, yeah. In fact.
Hmm. Shame you don't get points for yellow cards. Or you get disciplinary points, which is actually a metric you can look at. But it doesn't put you up the league table. Will, two to beat.
Villarreal's 35-year-old magician, Santi Cazorla.
True.
Is the only La Liga midfielder to make 25-plus dribbles, tackles, and chances created from open play so far this season.
I know you love this stat, but false.
Yeah, false.
I'm going to go false as well.
True.
Oh.
that's
a first.
That's why you should just go in with one word answers, because you think you influenced these two answers, but thanks very much. Because
maybe I'll be nice. I thought the open play was your little thing, because I know he loves his little corners, so I thought maybe you'd chuck that in there. From
Villarreal currently ninth and won the last three games in a row. Cazorla scored the match winner in the last one.
Yes, Santi.
He's involved in 10 top flight goals this season, which is joint most in his team.
He's been pretty great.
And did I mention he's 35?
Yes.
And has no ligaments and all that stuff.
Just no ankle.
Yeah.
The final, I've got to get a clean sweep, so you can stitch me up.
Go on then.
But be honest with yourselves. Gerard Piqué has made more tackles without being dribbled past by an opponent than any other player in the league of this season.
True.
False.
So you can't win.
So I can't win.
Do you want me to go anyway?
What?
Yeah. True.
It is false.
Yes.
The Nicaraguan Van Dijk, Oscar Duarte, has made 8 tackles, and all of them have been successful. Piqué, 19 tackles made, 4 times dribble pass, but none can stand up to Francesco Acerbi in Serie A for Lazio, who has made 29 tackles without being successfully dribbled past, the most in Europe's top 5 leagues. And in the Europa League, only Jozinho Niamsi from Stade Rennes has dribbled past him.
Nice. Does he smell nice, though?
Well done on the pronunciations of all those teams, by the way.
I tried. I don't know if they're correct, but I was trying.
They were convincing, at least.
So, Will, you're this week's winner, which we decided the prize would be... You can pick the league next time we do it. But don't tell anyone. You'll have to tune in to the next Squawker Talker podcast, sponsored by BetBull, next time.